York. This is Democracy Now!
We had an election that was stolen from us. It was a landslide election, and everyone knows it, especially the other side.
As Republicans try to downplay the deadly January 6th insurrection by Trump supporters, Trump met Thursday with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who has yet to appoint Republicans to the committee investigating the riot. We'll speak with journalist Michael Wolff, author of the new book, Landslide, The Final Days of the Trump White House. Then we look at the catastrophic impact of the climate crisis around the world.
We've continued to warm up the planet by burning fossil fuels and adding carbon pollution to the atmosphere. And a result of that, we are now seeing unprecedented heat waves and wildfires and droughts and floods and superstorms that play out now in real time on our television screens, like what we're witnessing this summer.
We'll speak with leading climate scientist Michael Mann. His new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. And as wildfires rage through the Northwest, we look at the corporate profiteering and how those who are making money off of those who've lost homes and loved ones in recent fires in California. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Los Angeles County will require everyone, including those who've been vaccinated against COVID-19, to resume wearing masks indoors as infections of the Delta variant continue to rise across the United States. After months of decline, hospitalizations and deaths have begun climbing again, with over 35,000 U.S. infections reported Thursday. The biggest hotspots are in areas with low vaccination rates, but cases are rising in nearly every state. Meanwhile, vaccinations have slowed to just over 500,000 shots per day, down from a peak of over 3 million daily shots in April. At the White House, Surgeon General Vivek Murthy called on social media companies to stop the spread of anti-vaccine misinformation that's costing lives.
On a personal note, it's painful for me to know that nearly every death we are seeing now from COVID-19 could have been prevented. I say that as someone who has lost 10 family members to COVID-19 and who wishes each and every day that they had had the opportunity to get vaccinated.
In Indonesia, volunteer undertakers have begun collecting the bodies of COVID victims from homes after hospitals filled to capacity. Indonesia is Southeast Asia's worst-hit nation and logged another record number of infections Thursday. In Burma, doctors say the military regime that seized power in the February coup is hoarding limited supplies of oxygen amidst a massive surge in COVID cases. Thailand's government is considering additional lockdown measures after confirming a record number of infections. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warns COVID cases continue to surge across the African continent. This is the WHO's Africa Regional Director, Dr. Matsidi Moete.
Deaths have climbed steeply for the past 5 weeks, jumping 40% in the past week. This is a clear warning. Our hospitals are at a breaking point. In all, 153,000 people have sadly died.
The Congressional Progressive Caucus is calling on German Chancellor Angela Merkel to stop obstructing a waiver of intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines at the World Trade Organization. In a statement, the Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal wrote, quote, "As long as Germany withholds its approval of the TRIPS waiver, it threatens the lives of millions of people around the world and our ability to crush the virus," unquote. Her statement came as protesters briefly confronted Merkel outside the White House as she arrived for talks with President Biden. The World Health Organization warns the pandemic triggered a massive decline in the number of children vaccinated against measles, polio, meningitis, and other preventable diseases. This is WHO Immunization Director Kate O'Brien.
The COVID-19 pandemic has led to major backsliding on childhood vaccination, taking us back more than a decade. An estimated 23 million children have missed out on basic vaccines through the routine immunization services in 2020. That is the highest number of unprotected children since 2009.
Over 110 people have died following massive floods in West Germany and Belgium, triggered by some of the heaviest rainfall many European countries have seen in at least a century. Most of the fatalities are in Germany, where some 1,300 people have also been reported missing. Several villages in Germany are almost completely destroyed after torrents of water, often carrying trees and other debris, raged through them. Heavy floods were also reported in Luxembourg and the Netherlands, where thousands of people in the southern province of Limburg were told to evacuate on Thursday. Raging wildfires in the western United States and Canada are filling the sky with smoke across much of North America. Hazardous air quality was reported Thursday in Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and Minnesota, with hazy conditions as far east as New York. In California, a rapidly growing wildfire prompted officials to order the evacuation of a community just 10 miles from the town of Paradise, which was almost completely destroyed by a fire 3 years ago. In Oregon, the massive bootleg fire has now consumed an area larger than New York City. New research published in the journal Nature confirms that parts of the Amazon rainforest are emitting more carbon dioxide than they absorb, driven by deforestation, fires, and warming temperatures. The findings come as new data from Brazil's government showed record levels of deforestation in the Amazon for the fourth straight month. We'll have more on the catastrophic impacts of the climate crisis later in the broadcast. The Washington Post is reporting that an unspecified number of Colombian nationals arrested over Haitian President Jovenel Moise's assassination last week received U.S. military training while they were part of the Colombian armed services. On Thursday, the Colombian president, Iván Duque, said some of the ex-soldiers who were part of the assassination team were aware of the plot to kill Moise, while others thought they were there to provide security. Authorities say key suspects had met in Florida and the Dominican Republic over the past year to plot the assassination. But participants to those meetings say they were planning ahead for when Moise stepped down as president. Meanwhile, the U.S. sent 500,000 of the first COVID-19 vaccine doses to Haiti this week and promised to send more. It's the first batch of vaccines Haiti has received. On Thursday, President Biden was asked if the U.S. would send military forces into Haiti.
We're only sending American Marines to our embassy to make sure that they are secure and nothing is out of whack at all. But the idea of sending American forces into Haiti is not on the agenda at this moment.
During that same news conference, Biden called Cuba a failed state and said communism is a, quote, universally failed system. Biden offered to send vaccines to Cuba if they would be administered independently of the government. But Cuba's handling of the pandemic has resulted in far fewer deaths and cases than the U.S., proportionate to its population. Cuba is also developing several domestic vaccines. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel has blamed the recent unrest and economic crisis on the devastating U.S. blockade and sanctions against Cuba. South Africa's government says it has deployed 25,000 troops to protect businesses after crowds ransacked and burned retail shops and warehouses during several days of protest. It's one of the largest deployments of South African troops since the end of white rule under apartheid. The demonstrations erupted after former President Jacob Zuma began his 15-month jail sentence for refusing to testify in a corruption probe. They've since focused on grinding poverty and record levels of unemployment exacerbated by the pandemic. In the Netherlands, the renowned crime reporter Peter R. de Vries died yesterday after being shot in an attack in Amsterdam last week. The 64-year-old was a household name in the Netherlands, investigating cold case killings and reporting on organized crime for decades. He'd received death threats in the past and was previously given police protection. In a statement, the de Vries family said, quote, "We are unbelievably proud of him and at the same time inconsolable." Back in the United States, the IRS has begun monthly payments to the families of nearly 60 million children, averaging out to $483 per family. The payments are in advance on a temporary increase in the child tax credit as part of the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan signed by President Biden in March. At the White House, Biden hailed the payments as the biggest new government benefit since Social Security.
For every child under the age of six, a parent will get $3,600 a year. For every child 6 to 17, they'll get $3,000 per year. And to give you a sense of how transformative this would be the largest ever one-year decrease in child poverty in the history of the United States of America.
The payments are set to expire at the end of the year unless Congress takes action to extend the higher child tax credit beyond 2021. In immigration news, President Biden's pick to head Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, testified in front of the Senate Thursday in his confirmation hearing. Harris County Sheriff Ed Gonzalez of Texas pledged to uphold the rule of law and said he planned to continue allowing state and local law enforcement agencies to collaborate with ICE. His comments were a stark contradiction to Gonzalez's previous move to end the controversial program in Harris County in 2017 during his time as sheriff there. Immigrant justice advocates also condemned Gonzalez for not mentioning plans to address the systemic abuse and accusations of human rights violations that have plagued ICE for years. A new report by the Justice Department's Inspector General finds Indianapolis FBI officials for months failed to properly investigate serious sexual abuse accusations against former USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar, stating FBI officials exhibited extremely poor judgment. The report found the former agent in charge of the Indianapolis FBI office and another unnamed agent failed to follow up with key witnesses or alert other law enforcement agencies of the crimes. The neglect led to Nassar abusing or assaulting more than 100 other gymnasts between the time the FBI first heard of the accusations in 2015 until Nassar's arrest the following year. The two FBI agents also made false statements and omitted key information in trying to hide failures in the Nassar investigation. In 2018, Nassar was sentenced to up to 175 years in prison for sexually assaulting and abusing more than 160 women and girl athletes. And in Washington, D.C., Capitol Police arrested at least 9 people as they took part in a demonstration at a Senate office building in defense of voting rights led by prominent black women. One of those arrested was Ohio Congress member, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Joyce Beatty.
Turn me around, we fight for voting rights, and we turn me around, we're gonna keep on.
The group chanted, "Pass the For the People Act." Congressmember Beatty wore a T-shirt reading, "Protect Our Voting Rights." She tweeted an image of herself walking with arm's length to other black women defending democracy, writing, quote, "We will not be turned around. We will keep walking. We will fight for freedom. We will fight for our right to vote," she said. Following her arrest, Congressmember Beatty also tweeted hashtag good trouble, quoting her friend, the late congressmember and civil rights leader, John Lewis. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former President Donald Trump met with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy Thursday, as McCarthy has yet to appoint Republicans to the congressional committee investigating the deadly January 6th riot by Trump supporters. For months, Republicans have downplayed the insurrection, which was time to disrupt the counting of electoral votes. McCarthy's meeting with Trump came after the Select Committee investigating the Capitol riot said it would hold its first hearing about the attack on July 27th. After the meeting, McCarthy returned to Washington, D.C. from the Bedminster Trump Hotel to attend a dinner at the White House with President Biden and visiting German Chancellor Angela Merkel. CNN reports McCarthy will likely appoint supporters and defenders of Trump to the January 6th committee. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi can veto any of his picks. This comes as a series of new books offering new details about what happened January 6th when then-President Trump spoke to thousands of his supporters at a so-called Save America rally outside the White House and urged them to march on the Capitol building.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol, and we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women, and we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them, because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength, and you have to be strong.
To talk more about what happened January 6th, what led up to it, and particularly those last weeks of the Trump administration, we're joined by Michael Wolff, author of the new book Landslide, The Final Days of the Trump White House, which completes his best-selling trilogy on the presidency of Donald Trump following Fire and Fury and Siege. Michael, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't we start off right there when President Trump, I don't know how many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lies this was, but said that he will join the others in walking to the Capitol. Did he ever have a plan to do that?
Well, it was at that moment, to just to set the background here, this was a speech that he was largely reading off the teleprompter, which is unusual for Trump. Certainly when he's in the moment, enthusiastic, he's departing from a speech. So he wasn't really thinking about this. His mind was wholly on Mike Pence and he believed that Mike Pence had the power and the willingness to throw out the electoral votes and install him as the president. That was on his mind. So he was sort of reading through this speech. But at one point, he did depart from the speech and said, "We will walk to the Capitol." And that was the moment at which all of his aides kind of looked up and said, "What did he say? We're going to walk to the Capitol." And all of them had the same response. What is he talking about? Donald Trump doesn't walk anywhere. So that's what they all thought at that point. And then when he came down after the speech, they said, "You know, we can't do that. There's no security for that." And Trump responded, "What are you talking about?" And they said, "You said you were going to walk." And he said, "I didn't mean that literally." So again, we're in the world of Donald Trump, which is mostly a world of what's coming out of his mouth, and I would say that for a good part of the time, he's not even aware of what's coming out of his mouth.
So, I mean, this is particularly significant right now for some who are thinking, why do we have to talk about Donald Trump? He's not the president anymore, even if he thinks he is. But the fact is, he by far is the leading contender if he chooses to run for president again, by far. And of course, just yesterday, the House Minority Leader went to the Bedminster Golf Course to meet with President Trump. And he, Kevin McCarthy, has yet to choose the five Republican members of the committee. They quashed the commission that would investigate the insurrection. Also, just interesting to note that you have the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Beatty, being arrested yesterday with nine others. They were arrested in less time than it took Capitol Police, who were, to say the least, taken off guard, to arrest that number that day in the time of extremely violent riot insurrection.
Well, I mean, I think that there's no question Donald Trump runs the Republican Party. He is it's entirely top down. Nearly everybody, or at least certainly everybody who is contemplating a future in the Republican Party, has to pay has to constantly kiss the Trump ring. Yes.
And so the significance of this right now, with him being in Mar-a-Lago, where you did a last interview with him in Bedminster, running the show from behind the scenes, the significance of what that means for politics in this country, for example, even this investigation. And when you spoke to him in Mar-a-Lago, what did he say about the insurrection? What did he say about the number of the police that he supposedly so reveres being devastated, traumatized, beaten? One died.
Yeah, he didn't say anything about the January 6th. That's clearly a subject that he is steering clear of. But, you know, I want to make another point, and I think it's an interesting point, that even though Donald Trump has a kind of lockstep control over the Republican Party. One of the things that's also always going on is while every Republican acknowledges that, every Republican is also trying to walk that back or mitigate that or slow walk whatever the president wants. So we have two realities here. The reality of Donald Trump in charge, and the other reality, which is that everybody knows that there's something wrong with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is crazy. Donald Trump, essentially can't put two sequential thoughts together. So Kevin McCarthy is going down there, and he's perfectly well aware this is an aberrant situation. And in fact, and the Trump himself is always saying bad things about McCarthy out of the side of his mouth. It's this incredibly unusual situation of which, I mean, it's essentially an emperor's new clothes situation. Everybody recognizes the completely unusual nature of what's going on here, but nobody can do anything about it.
Michael Wolff, you detail election night and the significance of the relationship between Fox and President Trump. Can you talk about what happened that night when Fox, before the other networks, called Arizona for Biden?
Sure. And that's another example of this. I mean, OK, so we have Fox News Network in abject fealty to Donald Trump. That's their entire business and programming strategy, bow down to Donald Trump. At the same time, the Murdoch family, who owns Fox, could change Fox at a second's notice if they wanted to, detests Rupert Murdoch, cannot stand him, and that night, in their own sort of guerrilla action against Murdoch, when the call when the call came from the election desk, which was that, you know, we can call Arizona now. We're confident about that. However, you know, we can also wait on this. So this decision went to Rupert Murdoch, and Rupert Murdoch said, I noticed on your instructions that you advise against using obscenities here. So I'll let you phrase this if you want to. But anyway, Murdoch delivered an obscenity directed at Donald Trump and said, yes, make the call now. And it was a devastating call for Trump at that moment on election night.
He said, make the effing call.
That's what he said. No, he didn't say that. He said, F him. In other words, directed to Trump himself.
And what about Fox letting the White House know that they're going to make this call?
Yeah, and I mean that got some attention, and so minutes before they made the call, Bill Hemmer, one of the Fox on air people, called Jason Miller, who was one of the key campaign aides, and said, hey, this is what's going down. We're going to make this call. We can't do anything about it. So when this came out that I had reported this, then Fox immediately said, that's totally untrue, completely untrue. A lot of other, publications immediately went to say, okay, Michael Wolff is wrong. And then Jason Miller said, oh yeah, that was true. Many people heard that.
Jason Miller, a surrogate for Donald Trump, who also
exactly.
who appeared on Fox.
Yes. And who got the call.
So,
so the call went from Bill Hemmer to Jason Miller, who said then, yes.
And so you're a close observer of the right networks, of the right-wing networks like Fox, OANN, Newsmax, maybe not as close as Trump himself, who you say spent hours every day, I mean, just hours watching these networks.
I am pretty close. I am, in addition to writing books about Trump, I'm Rupert Murdoch's biographer. So, yes, I'm pretty familiar.
And so what about the role of Fox now, and particularly the role of Sean Hannity?
Well, you know, Hannity is in, I'm trying to find the word. What would be the word? Cahoots, I suppose, with Donald Trump. As a matter of fact, there's one point in Landslide where I during the campaign, and which I outline, in which Sean Hannity calls the president and said, you know, your campaign is terrible. You know, you really need some help here. And he says, and I've written an ad for you. And then the president calls up the campaign and says, Sean says the campaign is terrible. You know, this goes on. And then the campaign, in trying to keep Hannity from calling the president and then having the president call the campaign then produces the ad. They literally make Hannity's ad. And then they only run the ad on Hannity's show. So in some weird thing going on here, Hannity gets the campaign to essentially give the Fox network a couple of million dollars to run this ad. Only on his show.
Which, of course, is always helpful because there are all these boycotts against advertisers on his show.
So, again, you know, yes, I mean, this is a consuming relationship. You know, Hannity works for Donald Trump, or Donald Trump works for Sean Hannity. You can barely separate this. But I would say that Hannity is certainly, and has been for 4 years, one of Trump's closest outside advisors.
Finally, I want to ask you about the man who did not desert President Trump, and he is Rudy Giuliani. He now has had his law license suspended by the state of New York, by Washington, D.C. Talk about his pivotal role as you—
And also for his trouble, Trump no longer speaks to him. As a matter of fact, Rudy Giuliani cannot get a call through to the former president at this point. So, you know, it's one of the, you know, a constant Trump theme, you know, whoever, the closer you get to Donald Trump, the more you get burned by Donald Trump. But, which is not at all to excuse Rudy Giuliani, who has been a persistent a part of the Trump toxicity and the Trump insanity, really. And one of the things which I constantly point out in the book, because it certainly is could not be more germane, is that Rudy is drunk all the time. So, stepping back from this, you know, we see the Trump administration as in part terrifying and as in part engaged in all of this destructive behavior. But on another level, it's also absurd. It's the gang that couldn't shoot straight. None of these people can do anything. I mean, they're either drunk or they're incompetent. As we told the story, as the story unfolded about Donald Trump's, effort to undermine the election, what was seldom said, certainly by the established media, is that he had no ability to do this. He had no, he couldn't work the levers of government. Everybody had deserted him. This was just a weeks and weeks and weeks of utter ridiculousness. As I said a couple of times, it isn't really the big lie; it's the big lunacy, and Donald Trump is the lunatic in chief.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Michael Wolff, author of the new book Landslide: The Final Days of the Trump White House, which completes his best-selling trilogy on the Trump presidency. Next up, we look at the catastrophic impact of the climate crisis around the world with leading climate scientist Michael Mann. Stay with us.
We gotta go back to the start, back to we are back home. We gotta go back to the start, back to
Wisdom Cries by Aurora. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As wildfires rage in California, we look now at the corporate profiteering off of those who've left their homes. We're going to do that in a moment, but we're going to first look at the catastrophic impact of the climate crisis around the world. This week, the heaviest rainfall This week, the heaviest rainfall many European countries have seen in at least a century caused rivers to burst their banks, devastating the region. At least 110 people have died in massive floods in western Germany and Belgium. Most of the fatalities are in Germany, where some 1,300 people have also been reported missing. Floods reported in Luxembourg and the Netherlands, where thousands were told to evacuate Thursday. Germany's Vice Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, blamed the deadly floods on man-made climate change.
This is a natural disaster, but the fact that this natural disaster is taking place in this way is certainly connected to the fact that climate change is progressing at a speed that we have observed for a while. That must be another incentive and also an obligation for all those who have become victims here, for us to do everything we can to stop man-made climate change and prevent such disasters in this scale.
This comes as new research published in the journal Nature shows portions of the Amazon rainforest in South America now emit more carbon dioxide than they absorb, with deforestation, fires, and warming temperatures as the main factors. New data from the Brazilian government shows deforestation of the Amazon rainforest rose for a fourth straight month in June. Greenpeace campaigner Ramiro Batista said it's part of a disturbing trend under the far-right president Jair Bolsonaro.
Unfortunately, the month of June brought more bad news for the rainforest. After a century of fires, there was a record level of deforestation. There was over 1,062 square kilometers of destruction across the entire forest. This continues to happen because of the government's environmental policy and also because it's encouraged by the National Congress.
Meanwhile, another punishing heat wave is set to bring triple-digit temperatures to at least 17 million people in the United States and Canada this weekend, as a record wildfire season fueled by the climate crisis shows no sign of letting up. Over 1 million acres of the western U.S. and Canada are now in flames. For more, we're joined by Michael Mann, distinguished professor and director of the Earth Science Center, Penn State University. His new book is called The New Climate War: The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Professor Mann, start off by talking about this catastrophe from the Northwest to the flash floods in Europe.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's good to be with you. It's unfortunate what we're witnessing play out. This is what we climate scientists predicted decades ago. We said that if we don't stop burning fossil fuels and elevating the levels of carbon pollution in the atmosphere, and we continue to warm up the planet, we will see unprecedented heat waves and wildfires and floods and droughts and superstorms. And guess what? That's what we're seeing. And it's playing out in a profound way right now. I was impressed by the way it came up in this press conference, this joint press conference between Joe Biden and Angela Merkel yesterday, where she was talking about these unprecedented floods that are impacting Germany. And of course, Joe Biden is the president of a country that is witnessing unprecedented heat extremes and extreme weather events as well. And so the fact that we're in both of these countries right now are witnessing the devastating impacts of climate change really drove home the point that she made, that we have to act now. Dangerous climate change is here. Catastrophic climate change is here. And at this point, it's a matter of how bad we're willing to let it get.
So talk about the climate emergency and the absolute proof that you have. I mean, you were just part of a group of scientists who said there is absolutely no question here when we look at these fires in the Northwest, what's behind them.
Yeah, you know, there are sophisticated experiments that climate scientists do now where we call them attribution. And we can look like at an event like that heat dome out west, and we can run climate models, theoretical climate models, and we can do two different experiments. In one experiment, we pretend the Industrial Revolution didn't happen, and we keep those CO2 levels, those carbon dioxide levels, at pre-industrial levels. In the other simulation, we account for the increase in greenhouse gases from fossil fuel burning from human activity. And we see how often those sorts of events happen in both cases. In this counterfactual case where we didn't warm the planet, and in the real world where we did. And we can estimate how likely that event was before we warmed up the planet and how likely it is now. And what those estimates suggest, it was a 50,000-year event. You wouldn't expect to see an event like this once in 50,000 years in the absence of the warming of the planet. Here's the kicker. What they found is that you wouldn't expect to see this event even once in 1,000 years, given what the models say the impact of climate change has been. And we and other scientists have argued that's because the models actually aren't capturing some of the processes, like the way these weather systems become stalled as the jet stream slows down as a result of the warming of the planet. The models don't take that into account, so they're still underestimating the impact that we are having on these extreme weather events.
In other horrific climate news, Michael, a new research shows portions of the Amazon rainforest are now emitting more carbon dioxide than they absorb. Can you explain the significance of this and how this not only threatens the rainforest, but the planet?
Yeah, I can't overstate the significance of this. Look, we've relied upon the fact that there are these natural sinks in the climate system. The oceans take up some of the carbon dioxide. What we call the terrestrial biosphere, the rainforests of the world in particular, take up some of that carbon dioxide. And because of that, those carbon pollution levels haven't been rising as fast as they should have, given how much carbon pollution we're putting into the atmosphere. About half of that carbon pollution was being taken up by these natural carbon sinks. Though the fact that some of these sinks are now turning into sources, not only aren't they absorbing CO2, taking it out of the atmosphere, they're actually adding CO2 to the atmosphere, is a real worry. And it reminds us that there are some surprises in store, and they're not pleasant surprises. This is one of them, and it suggests that we may see even higher levels of carbon pollution than most of the models have predicted. That's a problem.
Michael Mann, can you talk about the infrastructure bill and why we're talking about, really, the future of the planet here?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things here. First of all, when it comes to infrastructure, we've got to face the fact that we are dealing with a climate crisis now. Out in the West, the devastating heat and the wildfires. Back East, the flooding events we've seen. And that means we need to provide funding for massive increases in our resilience to deal with the impacts of climate change that are already here and that we can't prevent. But the other side of that is, sure, we have to adapt to the changes that are now inevitable, but we have to prevent the changes that are still preventable. And that means we've got to invest massively in renewable energy. We've got to use all the mechanisms available to us to disincentivize fossil fuels. And what I like about this, at least the current draft of the $3.5 billion reconciliation package, is that there is an allowance for what's known as a clean air standard or a clean energy standard, rather, which would require that utilities by 2030 provide as much as 80% of their energy, their power generation from renewable sources. I would love to see a price on carbon. I would love to see a cap and trade system. But this clean energy standard will make a real difference. And we have to make sure that that package is passed and that that item stays in the bill, because this is the greatest threat we face. Look, the coronavirus threat is this, you know, currently has taken up much of our resources, much of our attention. But that crisis, you know, within a year or two, it'll be behind us, and the climate crisis will still loom large. That's the greatest crisis we face, and we have to deal with it now.
Can you talk about the connection between the two?
Sure thing. There's so many lessons that we can learn from COVID-19, from the coronavirus. The importance of listening to science, of listening to scientists. Science denial is deadly. And that was unfortunately seen in the hundreds of thousands of deaths that could have been prevented if we had had a president who was willing to do what public health officials were telling him needed to be done. Here's the thing. Climate change is far more deadly and will cost far more lives if we fail to deal with it. And so there are other lessons about, you know, the fragility of our existence on this planet and the importance of finding a way to live sustainably.
And humans encroaching on the animal world and that kind of interaction.
Absolutely. You know, our impact on the natural world, you know, has led, you know, fossil fuel burning, deforestation has this causal connection with the climate crisis. But we're also destroying critical ecosystems that are forcing these exotic species out of their normal range where they come into contact with human beings and you get these pandemics. And so so many of the problems we face today stem from the unsustainable way that we are, you know, acting right now when it comes to this planet.
Which brings me to this Greenpeace expose. And, you know, Greenpeace recently tricking a lobbyist, a top lobbyist at ExxonMobil, into sharing secrets about the oil company's efforts to fight climate initiatives in Washington. The lobbyist, Keith McCoy, spoke candidly about his work, thinking he was speaking to a corporate headhunter. This is part of what he said.
Did we aggressively fight against some of the science? Yes. Did we hide our science? Absolutely not. Did we join some of these shadow groups to work against some of the early efforts? Yes, that's true. But there's nothing illegal about that. We were looking out for our investments. We were looking out for our shareholders.
That's Exxon lobbyist Keith McCoy, who went on to tell Greenpeace that Exxon's support for carbon tax is a public relations ploy because such a tax will never be implemented. He also identified 11 U.S. senators seen as crucial to Exxon's lobbying efforts, including the key Democrat West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin.
Joe Manchin, I talk to his office every week, and he is the kingmaker on this because he's a Democrat from West Virginia, which is a very conservative state, and he's not shy about sort of staking his claim early and completely changing the debate.
So this is so key, Michael Mann. Some people might think Joe Biden's in charge. Others might think it's the other Joe. It's Joe Manchin. But the idea of what ExxonMobil is suggesting, having him in their pocket and what he's defending. Talk about the significance of this.
Yeah, it was sort of a Wizard of Oz moment there. We got a little bit of a peek behind that curtain. You know, pay no attention to the hundreds of millions of dollars the fossil fuel industry has been spending to pollute the public discourse on climate change. You know, so what we got was a glimpse of what we knew was going on. It was an admission on the part of an ExxonMobil lobbyist of what we have known has been going on for decades, that rather than heeding what their own scientists had said, back in the early 1980s, there was an internal ExxonMobil report that called the potential impacts of climate change catastrophic. But ExxonMobil buried that report. They fired that research division and instead spent hundreds of millions of dollars in a massive disinformation campaign to discredit the very sort of science that their own scientists had had produced. And so, you know, it really does drive home the fact that there are bad actors involved in the new climate war. I talk about the tactics of these bad actors. And as climate change denial becomes impossible because of the impacts that we're now seeing play out in real time, you can't deny climate change is happening. So instead, they're resorting to all other sorts of tactics in their effort to slow this necessary transition away from fossil fuels. And, you know, getting a few Democratic senators to do their bidding for them has proven to be a very effective strategy of blocking action, because that's all they care about. They don't care about why we, you know, don't act on the climate crisis. They just want to make sure that we don't act on the climate crisis. And we have to make sure that they're not successful and that we hold our policymakers accountable.
Professor Mann, what do you think is the most important thing to take away from your book? What is your critical message here?
There is still time. Don't let the doomers convince you it's too late to do anything about climate change. That leads us down the same path of inaction as outright denial. And the inactivists, the forces of inaction, would love nothing more than for environmental progressives to remain on the sidelines because they're convinced it's too late to do anything. It isn't too late, but we have to act, and we have to act now.
Michael Mann, distinguished professor and director of the Earth System Science Center, Penn State University. His new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Next up, as wildfires rage in California, we look at the corporate profiteering of those who lost their homes and loved ones in the recent fires. Stay with us.
You went and put a number, and now there's smoke already in our lungs. And the season's just begun. There is smoke already in our lungs. It's just begun. Why do we wait?
Ablaze by Tarty. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As wildfires rage in California, we look at now at the corporate profiteering off of those who lost their homes and loved ones to recent fires. A major investigation by NPR and PBS station KQED in San Francisco found a special trust set up to distribute $13.5 billion to survivors of wildfires caused by PG&E, California's largest utility company, instead spent lavishly on its own administration while distributing almost nothing to the 70,000 fire victims. This includes victims of the 2018 Camp Fire in Paradise, many of whom continue to live in trailers. Those who profited while the fire victims waited for help include Wall Street bankers and prestigious law firms. KQED revealed the Fire Victim Trust is led by retired California Appeals Court Justice John Trotter, who billed $1,500 an hour for his work. The findings have prompted a bipartisan call from state lawmakers for the California Attorney General to investigate. For more, we go to Berkeley, California, to speak with the reporter behind this expose. Lily Jamali is co-host and a correspondent for KQED's The California Report. Her latest piece is headlined, "A Year After PG&E Left Bankruptcy, Spending by Fire Victim Trust Remains a Mystery." Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lily. Congratulations.
It's so good to be on with you, Amy. Thank you.
And congratulations on this excellent report. Why don't you lay it out for us and for a global audience, explain what PG&E is and its role in these fires, and then go on from there.
Sure. Well, this was a joint investigation that was done with us at KQED and with NPR's California Newsroom. And as you mentioned, PG&E is the largest utility in California. It's actually the largest utility in the country as well. And in the last half decade, this utility has been responsible for causing several catastrophic wildfires. The worst took place in 2017 and 2018, but there are people who were affected by these fires all the way back to 2015. And so after that last fire, which you mentioned, the Camp Fire, which destroyed much of the town of Paradise, people might remember that it killed at least 85 people, destroyed thousands of homes and left tens of thousands of people homeless. After that fire, PG&E chose to go into Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. And by doing that, they took all of these claims that people had against them, having lost their homes, having lost their businesses, and in the worst cases, having lost their loved ones, they all got thrown into the bankruptcy process. And so that's sort of where the story that we have been reporting really begins. About a year into the bankruptcy, PG&E struck a deal with fire survivors, 70,000 of them, through their lawyers that basically called for them to have this special trust set up to distribute what was then marketed to them as being worth $13.5 billion. Half of it in cash and half of it in PG&E stock, which, as you might imagine, is very unsettling for a lot of fire survivors, this idea of being asked to accept stock in the company that harmed them. But as we sit here today, through this trust, fire survivors do own 500 million shares of PG&E. And so that is part of the reason why it has taken quite a bit of time to get this money into the hands of victims. But our investigation also looked at the claims processing expenses that this trust, led by former appeals court justice John Trotter, how much they have taken in overhead. He is charging $150,000 a month. The top claims administrator charges $1,250 an hour. There's a whole coterie of bankruptcy attorneys and financial advisors, many of whom are making well over $1,000 an hour. And so you really have this giant entity that is taking in a lot of money. We showed that they took in $50 million in overhead in their first year of operations while distributing just $7 million in the calendar year 2020 to these fire survivors. The pace of those payments to fire survivors has picked up. At this point, they have distributed north of about $400 million, but their expenses have also risen to the range of about $80 to $90 million. And I think a lot of fire survivors are looking at this situation and wondering why this is taking so long. If you are spending this kind of money on overhead, what are they getting in return? And they're getting really impatient and they're very unhappy with the way this process has been run so far.
What is the status of the bipartisan calls for the California Attorney General to investigate this?
Yeah, so after our investigation, as you say, this was a bipartisan group of about a dozen state lawmakers here in California. Most of them, in fact, I think all of them represent communities who have been affected by these catastrophic fires. And they went to Attorney General Rob Bonta and said, you know, look at this. Please take a look and review the claims processing, the way it works, and the amount of money that's being spent on overhead. Please vet this. We have reached out to the Attorney General's office a number of times to see if they are planning to pick that up and run with it. At this point, we don't know. They've told us that they can't comment even on a pending investigation or can't comment on even if they're thinking about opening up an investigation. But certainly, you know, our work, thankfully, was able to get this in front of some influential lawmakers, including members of Congress who expressed outrage after we released our findings. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see what comes next.
What about Paradise and the areas right around it being threatened again? I mean, we're talking in the midst of more horrendous fires through California, Oregon, Washington State. And what kind of preparations are being made? You've also got PG&E last August instituting rolling blackouts that put 800,000 Californians into the dark. How can Governor Newsom, how are they, he's dealing with what's happening right now?
Yeah, I mean, I was so struck hearing your conversation earlier with Michael Mann, because you guys are talking about a climate emergency being here, and that is exactly what it feels like to live in California right now. The rolling blackouts of last year was actually instituted by the independent system operator here in California because they ran out of power. They didn't have enough reserve in their system, so they ended up instituting these rolling blackouts over 2 days in August. But there is another kind of blackout that is called by the utilities, including PG&E, because their lines have caused so many fires. That's one way that they now try to prevent their aging and poorly maintained equipment from sparking future fires. Generally, those kinds of those outages come a little bit later in the fire season when we see, for example, next month we'll see more wind events, and that's when the situation becomes really dire. But there's no doubt about it. We are in a climate emergency here. And one of the fires that we have been tracking among several is the Dixie Fire, which just broke out this week very close to the burn scar of the campfire. In fact, it started very close to the ignition point of the campfire. And I've been getting texts and emails
from 10 seconds.
People in Paradise who are very concerned, and they're seeing the smoke in the air, and they're worried. They're worried about what to do and how to make sure they're safe.
Well, Lily Jamali, I want to thank you so much for your superb reporting, co-host and correspondent for KQED's The California Report. We'll link to her investigation a year after PG&E left bankruptcy. Spending by fire victim trust remains a mystery. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.